Chapter 4. I have a sleep disorder and it's probably going to kill me or someone else. If you were to ask me, how did you sleep? I'd usually say, pretty well, all things considered. But today it's a bit more complicated because this morning I lost both of my arms. On the bright side, it gave me something to write about, although it was, of course, impossible to write about it at the time because I didn't have any working arms. There's a note here from my editor that says, start over, sound less ludicrous. Fine. This morning, I got up at 6 a.m. to get Haley off to school, but then I went back to bed for a bit because I'd been up since 2 a.m. having a dead raccoon rodeo in the kitchen. There's another editor's note here which just says, you know what? Never mind. The dead raccoon's name was Rory. I fell in love with him the instant I saw him because he looked exactly like Rambo, the rescued orphaned raccoon who lived in my bathtub when I was little. Rory hadn't been lucky enough to be adopted by a small child who would dress him up in small short sets and let him turn or sink into his own tiny waterfall. Instead, Rory had fallen in with a bad crowd and ended up as roadkill, but my friend Jeremy, a burgeoning taxidermist, saw great potential and very few tire marks on the cadaver and decided that Rory's tiny spirit should live on in the most disturbingly joyous way possible. Rory, the dead raccoon, stood up on his hind legs, his arms stretched out in glee. He looked like he was the most excited member of your surprise party or like a Time Lord in the process of regenerating. His bafflingly enormous smile caused people to giggle, usually nervously and somewhat involuntarily, whenever I presented him, or sometimes they'd scream and back away. I guess it depends on if you're expecting an unnaturally cheerful dead raccoon to pop out at you. Victor didn't entirely understand my love for Rory, but he couldn't disagree that Rory was probably the best raccoon corpse that anyone had ever loved. Rory's tiny arms perpetually reached out as if to say, oh my God, you are my favorite person ever. Please let me chew your face off with my love. Whenever I had accomplished a particularly impossible goal, like remembering to refill my ADD meds, even though I have ADD and was out of ADD meds, Rory was always there, eternally offering supportive high fives because he understood the value of celebrating the small victories. Victor might have refused to congratulate me on the fact that I hadn't fallen down a well that week, but that dead raccoon always had my back, and very few people can say that. Very few people would want to say that, Victor corrected. Well, it's just nice to have some unconditional encouragement and praise, I explained to him. Some people get all stingy with their high fives, but Rory never leaves me hanging. In fact, it is physically impossible for Rory to leave me hanging, and I momentarily considered having Victor one day taxidermied in the same happy, congratulatory pose, but then I realized that no one would recognize him, and he'd probably just look sarcastic. Like he was only offering me high fives when I slipped on things that weren't there, or when the electricity was cut off because I forgot to pay it again. Victor thinks that taxidermy is a waste of money, claiming that, quote, there are only so many things you can do with a dead raccoon. But I have proven him wrong time and time again. Victor pointed out that what he had actually said was, there are only so many things you should do with a dead raccoon. And honestly, that does sound a lot more like something he'd say, but I still disagree. When Victor was making Skype calls for work, I'd silently crawl up behind him and have Rory slowly and menacingly rise up over Victor's shoulder until the person on the call froze because they noticed a mentally unbalanced raccoon was leaning in like a furry eavesdropping serial killer. And then Victor would realize that Rory was behind him and he'd sigh that sigh that he does so well and remind himself to lock his office door. If anything, though, Victor should have thanked me because the perfect test to see if your friends and coworkers really have your back is if they're willing to say, hey, there's a raccoon creeping on you. It's like the is my fly down test, but times 1,000 because almost anyone can relate enough to clear their throat and raise an eyebrow at your junk until you realize you forgot to zip. But it takes a really concerned badass to interrupt a conference call and say, watch out for that motherfucking raccoon, dude. To their credit, most of Victor's callers would mention something, and I'd point out that they had passed the test, and then Rory would be like, jazz hands! And then Victor would lock us both out, and I'd stick Rory's paw under the office door and say in a small raccoony voice, I'm trying to help you, let me help you. When the mailman dropped off packages, I'd open the door a few inches and have Rory peek outside. "Well, hello," Rory would say in a snooty British accent. "I hope you don't need a signature because I seem to have misplaced my opposable thumbs." Eventually, the mailman just stopped ringing the bell and would leave the packages on the porch, which was nice because it cut down on all that awkward small talk. Sometimes, I'd hide him under the covers, Rory, not the mailman, so that when Victor turned down the bed, there was Rory on his pillow as if to say, "Surprise, motherfucker, there's a dead raccoon in your bed and he wants some snuggling." And then Victor would glare at me and make me switch pillows with him. Victor can't understand Rory's frenzied kind of love, but I think he's starting to accept that this is my love language. Other women might show their adoration with baked goods or hand-knitted slippers, but mine is channeled through animal corpses. Victor tries to interpret it as best he can, but he is a guy who keeps his emotions close to his vest when it comes to dead animals in bed, so honestly, it's hard to know what that man is really thinking. He is an enigma, that one. Last night, I realized that Rory was perfectly suited to ride on the cats, as if they were small, furry horses and he was a rodeo star. But apparently, the cats didn't realize how awesome it would be, and so they were incredibly uncooperative. I tried to create a photo montage of Rory the rodeo raccoon, but they weren't having it. I suspect if my cats had Instagram, they'd be all over this, but they don't, so they couldn't be bothered. I'd perch Rory on their backs and they'd stand still for a second, but by the time that I'd backed up and gotten them in focus, they'd turn around like, "What are you doing? Why is there a raccoon on my back? Why do they even let you be in charge of things?" And then they'd just flop over on their sides like a bunch of ingrates who didn't understand art. Rory would gently tumble onto the floor, which I suspect sent the cats a mixed message because he was still waving his hands in the air like he just didn't care. As if he was celebrating the cats being assholes, and I was like, "You're killing me, Smalls," but then he just celebrated the fact that I was frustrated. Honestly, it is impossible to stay mad at that raccoon. Sometime around 2 a.m., Ferris Mueller finally gave up and stayed upright, annoyed but resigned, as he carried an ecstatic Rory on his back, and I was like, "Yes, Ferris Mueller, you are America's next top model!" And then Victor opened the bedroom door and yelled, "What in the hell is going on out here? It's 2 o'clock in the damn morning!" And then Ferris panicked at all of the unexpected yelling, and he tore off down the hall, but Rory was still stuck to his back as Ferris streaked to the living room, and then Victor was like, "Holy shit, what the hell was that?" Because I guess his eyes hadn't adjusted to the light, or maybe to the sight of an ecstatic raccoon frolicking bareback on a house cat. I considered acting just as shocked as he was and claiming it was probably a small chupacabra that had snuck in, but then I thought that that would just raise more questions, so instead I lowered the camera and said, "What was what?" as innocently as possible. I prayed he'd just go away questioning his sanity, and he did, but probably less because I'd fooled him and more because he'd married someone who took secret pictures of cats wearing dead raccoons in the wee hours of the morning. It wasn't my fault, though. I have had chronic insomnia for as long as I can remember. These are the things that eventually happen when you're alone at 2 a.m. often enough. There's a note from my editor here. "Remember 3 pages ago when you said you lost your arms? How have we not gotten to that yet? Did you forget what the story is all about?" And a note from me, "I was just getting there. You can't just start off a story about missing arms without the proper context, apparently." I finally went to sleep at 3 a.m., woke up a few hours later to take Haley to school, and then crawled back in bed for a quick nap. It was lovely, but at 9:30, the alarm that I had set on my phone went off. I tried to reach over to turn it off, and that's when I realized that my left arm was missing. And I thought, "Well, that's odd." But then I looked over at my arm and was like, "Wait, no, there it is." It was flung awkwardly over my head and was completely numb because Hunter S. Tomcat was lying on it and had cut off all the circulation. I threw my shoulder toward the phone and Hunter grudgingly rolled over, but my arm just fell forward zombie-like. My hand almost grazed the phone, but I couldn't get my fingers to work enough to hit the snooze button. I glared furiously at my fingers like I was trying to telekinetically move an inanimate object, except that the inanimate object was my own hand. The alarm got louder, and so I tried to prop myself up with my other arm, but I ended up just flopping around like a fish out of water because my other arm was pinned behind me and was also asleep. This has never happened to me before, and it seemed like such an astronomically weird coincidence that I started to worry that I was accidentally in some sort of a partial coma that only affects arms, Or maybe I'd been selectively paralyzed, but that seemed unlikely since most people who've been paralyzed say, "I can't feel my legs," rather than "my arms stopped working." Hunter walked around to stare at me like, "Why aren't you turning off that noise? What is wrong with you?" which was very unhelpful. I managed to Frankenstein myself up into a sitting position, and I kept tossing my helpless arms near the snooze button, but it wouldn't work, and it got louder and louder, and I could hear Victor angrily stomping toward the bedroom, yelling, "Oh my God, are you still in bed?" I didn't want to tell him that not only was I still in bed, but also my arms weren't even awake yet, and so I panicked and quickly rolled off the edge of the bed to hide behind it. Obviously, I wasn't thinking straight because I forgot that I didn't have arms to help catch me, and so I landed face down with a dull thud, and that's when I realized how helpful it is to have working arms. You never think to appreciate your arms until you need them to stop the floor from punching you in the face. Hunter as Tomcat looked over the edge of the bed at me quizzically as if to say, "What in the hell are you doing? Is there food down there?" And he dropped to the floor beside me to check it out. Victor burst in, yelling, "Why is your alarm blaring? Some of us are on conference calls, you know." And I heard him huff and switch off the alarm. I looked at Hunter like, "Shh, say nothing and we'll be fine." And he stared back at me like, "What do you mean, we?" Victor paused, and I saw his feet moving toward the bathroom where he looked for me. And then he came back in and was like, "Where are you?" But I stayed quiet, and I waited for him to leave so that I could sneak out to my desk and pretend that I had been up for hours. My plan would have worked perfectly if Hunter hadn't decided to jump onto my hip so he could peer over the side of the bed and look at Victor like, "Why are you people doing this? Is this a game?" Then Victor walked around the bed and sighed, and I said, "No one's in here," but it sounded muffled because of the floor. He accused me of hiding from him rather than working, and I said, "No, actually, I'm down here trying to save you from the sight of your disabled and temporarily paralyzed wife because I'm trying to protect you." Then Victor gave me what I guess was a look of pity or maybe love. I don't know because I was still facing the floor, but I'm giving him the benefit of the doubt because that's what marriage is all about. I suddenly realized that all of this might make a pretty good chapter, and I wanted to write it all down, but I still didn't have arms to write with. So instead I said, "I've actually been down here working on my book, but I don't have a way to type. Can you just turn on the voice recognition part of my phone and lay it by my face so I can dictate notes because my arms don't work right now?" And Victor said, "Your arms don't work right now?" And I said, "Yes. Apparently, I slept wrong and lost circulation, and they're both still asleep." "Holy crap," he said. "You're so lazy that even your limbs are still sleeping when I'm talking to you." "Quite the contrary," I explained as I struggled to roll over onto my back. "I am so hardworking that I'm awake even when my body is still partially unconscious." And I'm like, "Fuck you, arms. I'll still be productive without you. That's how dedicated I am." I was starting to get some of the feeling back in my left arm, and I lifted it to try to brush Hunter away from my nose, but instead I just smacked myself in the face. Victor stared at me with concerned resignation. "You just hit yourself." "Yeah, it's possible my arms might be rebelling. Just put the phone next to my face and leave me. I have important work to do here." He shook his head with disappointment, but he still did it, and I started dictating. But the transcription app kept autocorrecting my story to something less ridiculous because even my phone was against me at that point. And then Hunter saw the words on the phone moving, and he kept pouncing on it and resetting the cursor. I laid my head down on the rug in defeat as the pain of pins and needles flooded my arms, and I wondered how often this sort of shit happened to Hemingway. Victor claims that these sort of things don't go on in a normal household, but I'm pretty sure this entire incident can be blamed on the fact that I have several real-life sleep disorders. This is not too surprising considering that I collect neurological disorders like other people collect comic books. Basically, I've become so talented at having disorders that I can literally have one in my sleep. Victor doesn't think this is really something to brag about, but that's probably because he doesn't have any disorders and he's jealous. Jesus, it's not a competition, Victor. But if it were a competition, I'd be winning. Handily. Victor had been pushing me to do a sleep study for years, but I'd felt it was a waste of time and money. I already knew I had a problem, so I didn't really want proof that I was fucked up even when I was unconscious. Besides, I wasn't the only one with sleep problems, as Victor had been talking in his sleep since he was a kid. When he was 8, he was traveling with his dad, and he sat up in a darkened hotel room at 2 a.m., opened his eyes, and raised his arm to point toward the dark hall, saying, "Who's that man standing in the corner?" Then he lay back down and went straight back to sleep while his father quietly shit himself. metaphorically. Probably. A few weeks ago, Victor woke himself up yelling, "Lady, you have the wrong number. Our cat isn't even in the hospital. He doesn't want pajamas." Poor Victor. Even in sleep, he's plagued by assholes. It might be hereditary, because my dad also has major sleep issues. I never really noticed it when I was a kid because you always assume that your family is normal until you realize that no one else's father stops in the middle of a conversation to tell them he needs a quick nap and then lies down on their living room floor for 20 minutes to snore so loudly it sounds as if he is the big bad wolf, but in reverse. No matter where we were or who we were with, my dad would often stop, lie down, and immediately go to sleep until he'd wake himself up choking on a snore. Once, Victor took my dad deep-sea fishing during a storm, and the boat was rocking like mad, and there was water and blood on the bottom of the boat, and everyone was seasick. And Daddy said, "Well, if no one else is going to take a nap, I will." And he lay down in the fish blood and slept soundly, but not soundlessly, for 40 minutes. To Victor and everyone else on the boat, this seemed insane, but to me, it seemed normal, and I thought Victor was overreacting and should just count himself lucky that my dad had kept his pants on. I inherited insomnia from my mom and the snoring daytime sleepiness from my dad. I also came up with my own brand of exhaustion and choking-related awesomeness, and Victor eventually said that he couldn't take it anymore and made me get help. My doctor thought I was most likely snoring and exhausted because of the insomnia and prescribed a hypnotic sedative. And it probably works really well for normal people, but the first time that I took it, I waited for it to make me sleepy and it never did. Several hours later, Victor found me in the closet where I claimed that I could see through postcards and that I had found the fifth dimension. Victor assumed I'd had some sort of a breakdown, which is sort of insulting because it's entirely possible that I did find the fifth dimension and he wasn't giving me the benefit of the doubt. Instead, he just put me to bed and called the doctor, who explained that she had forgotten to tell me that I have to go to bed immediately after I take the pill or my body will stay awake while my brain goes to sleep. She told Victor the same thing happened to her father, who was found wandering in the front yard wearing only socks, asking the trees why they hated him. And her mom ended up taking him to the ER because she assumed he must have had a stroke. That whole story sort of freaked me out, so I threw away the sedatives and all hope of visiting the fifth dimension again. And instead, I told Victor that I would go for a sleep study if he promised to stop videotaping me snoring and then playing it next to me to wake up so that I could, quote, feel his pain. I made an appointment with a sleep doctor who explained that during the sleep study, people would be watching me sleep and monitoring my brainwaves to see how I reacted during the four stages of sleep. I would explain those stages if I could spell all of those complicated words, but they basically range from wide awake to just barely not dead. My sleep cycle is a bit more elaborate. The seven stages of sleep according to my body. Stage one, you take the maximum dose of sleeping pills, but they don't work at all, and then you glare at their smug bottles at 3 a.m. whispering, "You lying bastards." Stage two, you fall asleep for 8 minutes, and you have that dream where you've missed a semester of class and you don't know where you're supposed to be. And when you wake up, you realize that even in sleep, you're fucking your life up. Stage three, you close your eyes for just a minute, but you never lose consciousness. And then you open your eyes and you realize it's been hours since you closed your eyes and you feel like you've lost time and were probably abducted by aliens. Stage four, this is the sleep that you missed because you're too busy looking up symptoms of alien abduction on your phone. Stage five, this is the deep REM sleep that recharges you completely and doesn't actually exist but is made up by other people to taunt you. Stage six, you hover in a state of half sleep when you're trying to stay under, but someone is touching your nose and you think it's a dream, but now someone is touching your mouth and you open your eyes and your cat's face is an inch from yours and he's like, "Boop, got your nose." Stage seven, you finally fall into the deep sleep you desperately need. Sadly, this sleep only comes after you're supposed to be awake and you feel guilty about getting it because you should have been up hours ago, but you've been up all night and now your arms are missing. I suspected that the only stage of sleep I would have during the sleep study would be the sleep you don't get because strangers are watching you. It was disconcerting right from the beginning because I went after sundown and the entrance to the clinic was literally in a dark back alley. I knocked on the locked door, which startled a homeless man who had been ironically or possibly sarcastically sleeping heavily, And I was fairly certain that this was the sort of place that would probably sell abortions by the dozen. But then the nurse opened the door, and it was very bright and pleasant and not very abortion-y at all. They put me in a bedroom, and the nurse asked if I wanted to change into pajamas. I self-consciously explained that the sweats that I was wearing were my pajamas, and then I felt like I was improperly dressed for sleep. Aside from that, though, it was just like being home, except for the video camera, the constant observation, the oxygen tubes up my nose, the monitors taped to my fingers, the electrodes glued to my scalp to track my brain waves. The electrode wires were the most uncomfortable because they ran all over my head like I was a Medusa with a bunch of anorexic snake hair. The silver lining, though, was that the weight of the wires pulled my face back like a mini facelift, so I looked surprisingly sexy if you ignored all of those anorexic snakes on my head. The nurse continually adjusted the forehead electrodes because she said that they weren't picking up a signal, and I'm pretty sure that was an insult. My nurse warned me that one of the patients was a sleepwalker, but that if he walked into my room, they would come and get him, and that was comforting in a way that wasn't really comforting at all. After several hours of staring at the ceiling, I drifted off and awoke to the sound of a woman next door screaming maniacally, and I assumed that she had been stabbed to death by the sleepwalker. I shot bolt upright, but the snakes in my hair were attached to the wall behind me, so they jerked me back down to the bed, and I thought to myself, well, this is a really fucked up way to die. The nurse rushed in to assure me that everything was fine and that the screaming woman just suffered from night terrors. I nodded agreeably as I watched the sleepwalker knock over a chair outside my door. I briefly considered escaping, but I was lightly shackled to the bed by wires and monitors, plus the nurses and orderlies were watching me, and for a minute, I realized this was probably a lot like being in a mental institution, except even crazier, because we had all come here voluntarily like some sort of terrible slumber party for weirdos. I was certain I wouldn't sleep again, but I must have, because at 4 a.m., a different nurse shook me awake and brusquely said, "You can go now, we got what we needed." She refused to tell me exactly what it was that they had gotten, and I started to suspect it was my kidneys. I was groggy, but they let me leave out the back door while it was still dark. It was like I'd had a one-night stand with a sleep clinic. A week later, my doctor had my results and informed me that I have pretty much all of the sleep disorders, except for the only one that I actually wanted to have, which is the apnea one where they give you that headgear that shoots oxygen up your nose. I wanted it because I'm pretty sure that's a smaller version of the oxygen chamber that Michael Jackson slept in to keep him from aging, and things seemed to work out pretty well for him. Sadly, I didn't have sleep apnea, but I have a number of other issues. A few things that are wrong with me when I'm not even conscious. Periodic limb movements during sleep. It's like restless leg syndrome, but it only happens after you're unconscious. I'm fine with it, though, because I think that means that my legs are jogging without me, which is honestly the only way you could ever get me to jog. When I was little, we had a dog that had the same issue, I think, because he was always running while he was asleep on his side, and we would look at his twitchy legs and say, "Oh, he's chasing rabbits in his sleep." It's pretty much the most adorable sleep disorder ever. Except, according to Victor, my version is not so much running adorably as it is some sort of ongoing exorcism, what with all the, quote, terrifying jerking and writhing about. Snoring. They didn't see me choking during the sleep study, but I often wake up choking and snoring loudly, although maybe that's because Victor's choking me for snoring loudly. I did snore a lot, though, so my doctor prescribed these clips that go inside your nostrils to make it easier to breathe, except that you have clips inside your nostrils now, so it actually makes it harder to breathe. I tried it exactly once, which was enough time to realize that the real snoring cure here was slow suffocation, which admittedly is a very quiet death. I also had an allergic reaction to the plugs, and both nostrils swelled up. This seemed like a more economical and organic way of smothering to death, but I still prefer snoring to asphyxiation. Call me crazy. Seizures. According to the doctor, quote, "It looks like you might have an uncommon seizure disorder, but there's no real cure for it." I asked the doctor what the point was in even telling me about it then. "Just keep an eye on it," he replied. I'm not sure how I would keep an eye on a disorder that only happens when I'm unconscious. I couldn't even tell if he was being sarcastic or not. Alpha intrusion. When you're asleep, you're supposed to have delta brainwaves, but apparently my brain is constantly getting interrupted with alpha waves, so I'm flooded with awake-like brain activity while my body is asleep, which means even when I'm asleep, I'm still awake. I suspect my brain is working in collusion with my legs and my whole body is forcing me to do algebra and work out while I'm sleeping. It's no wonder I'm so damn tired. And now that I think about it, Alpha Intrusion is all about part of you being asleep and the rest of you being awake, just like my arms this morning. Bam! It's like my brain just did a mic drop there. When I came home from the study, Victor didn't take my results very seriously until I pointed out that most people with Alpha Intrusion die. Then he looked concerned, and I felt bad, so I admitted that they don't actually die from alpha intrusion. Just, you know, most people die. Eventually. I can't imagine the intrusion helps, though. Victor sighed and assured me that no one ever died from not enough sleep, but I'm pretty sure they have, and then he paused and corrected himself. Okay, well, maybe it's no one ever died from too much sleep. And I was like, I think you just described a coma. This isn't helping. Fine, he said. Everyone has to die of something, but you're probably not going to die of sleep. And he's wrong, because best case scenario, I die in my sleep. I'll go to bed, and then I'll never wake up. Worst case scenario, I'm eaten by clowns. Footnote here, even then, though, I'd probably still lose consciousness before I die. In fact, pretty much everyone's final stage of death is the not waking up part. Although the whole never having insomnia again thing sounds a bit nice, and it probably says something about me that I'm a bit envious of people taking the big dirt nap. Not that I'm ready for that now. It's just nice to know that eventually I'll get sleep. A footnote on Rory. There are actually two Rory raccoons, Rory and his stunt double Rory 2. The first time I saw Rory was on the internet, and I fell in love and told his maker, Jeremy, that I had to have him. I explained how Rory perfectly displayed that furiously happy smile, and Jeremy agreed. Sadly, in between my falling in love with his photo and actually paying for him, Rory was involved in a tragic roller coaster accident in Las Vegas. This sounds like something I just made up, but I swear to you it is true. Rory's temporary guardians had taken him on a debaucherous Vegas weekend, and he had broken a few limbs. He had also left all of his fingers and toes behind, proving the old adage, what happens to break off in Vegas stays in Vegas. Jeremy was furious and broke the news to me gently, and he vowed to make me another Rory, better, stronger, and with wires inside so he would be poseable and could more effectively ride on the cats, with a raccoon corpse that he had in his freezer. How does the first Rory's face look? I asked. Still pleased as damn punch, he admitted, but the rest of him is a hot mess. I considered it for a moment and decided that a broken and tattered but still ecstatically happy Rory was pretty much exactly what being furiously happy was all about. After all, the most interesting of us have been broken and mended and broken again. I'll take him, I said. Hell, I'll take them both. And that's how I came to own two furiously happy raccoons. And I love the flexible perfection of Rory 2, who is slightly larger, but you can't be picky when you're only dealing with roadkill raccoons. But Rory 1 is the one who makes me laugh every time I look at him. Jeremy had mended his broken arm and leg, and my father spent an afternoon sculpting new fingers and toes for him. Rory still looks a bit off, but in a good way, and I'm currently looking for some infant-sized adamantium Wolverine claws for him. But even without the claws, he's lovely. He's broken and flawed and so strange that even people who like taxidermy still think, what the shit is going on here? Even as he's bringing joy and laughter into their lives. That raccoon is my goddamn role model. He is the worst and best Patronus ever, and I want to be just like him when I grow up. Chapter 5. How many carbs are in a foot? I think I'm the last person left on Earth who hasn't eaten kale or quinoa. People keep raving about there being the next big thing, but I'm still all frightened rabbit from the time Victor made me the last big thing, and I was like, this rice has gone bad, and I didn't even think rice could go bad, and then Victor explained that it was risotto, and I was like, the stuff Gordon Ramsay is always yelling about? This is very disappointing. It's as if risotto doesn't know if it's mashed potatoes or rice, and so it just decided to be both, but badly. Victor argued that it was really more like grits, but grits you can smother with cheese and butter, and that's pretty much cheating. I'd eat a human foot if it was smothered in enough cheese and butter. Then Victor called my bluff, saying you would not eat a human foot. You won't even finish the damn risotto. And I'm not sure if that was a dare, but it didn't matter because he's right. I'm way too lactose intolerant. Everyone else at the dinner party would be tucking into their cheesy Butterfoot, and I'd have to eat my foot parboiled and plain. That's my struggle, and it is very real. As a footnote, Victor just read this chapter, and he says that it sounds like I'm saying I would eat my own foot, and that's just ridiculous. I'm not even sure why I have to clarify this, but just to be clear, I wouldn't eat my own foot. That would be barbaric. Victor says that eating someone else's foot isn't exactly kosher, but obviously I wouldn't do it unless the foot was ethically harvested. Like how some indigenous tribes eat their dead as a sign of respect. You wouldn't turn that down without being somehow insulting. Oh, your cheesy foot looks delicious, but I just ate someone's grandma an hour ago and I am stuffed. No one's going to believe that. But frankly, I do sort of wonder how people taste. Cannibals say that we taste like pork, and bacon is my spirit animal, so we're probably delicious. I feel sorry for tribes that used to be cannibals, but then they had to stop when the Christians came and inevitably ruined everything like they do, because it would suck to be nostalgic for the comfort food of your childhood and never be able to have it again, because now it's suddenly not cool to eat your dead uncle. That's a shitty craving to have. Not that I would know. I've never eaten a person before. Hell, I've never even eaten kale. Second footnote, it just occurred to me that my footnote here is literally a note about a foot. That is awesome. High five me. I guess there's always a silver lining, even when it involves human feet you're too allergic to eat. Chapter 6. Pretend you're good at it. It wasn't enough blood to be worrisome. Not even enough to demand a stitch, but it wouldn't stop dripping unceasingly from my swollen foot. I was in New York in January to record the audiobook version of my soon-to-be-released first book and to attend a pre-launch lunch held to publicize my book. This is fairly normal in book publishing, but I was new to it and I was terrified on both accounts. The invitations to the luncheon were nicer than my wedding invites and everyone came. People from the New York Times, CBS, O Magazine, and others I didn't even know. My agent and publisher did their best to keep me unaware of the importance of this luncheon, as they both knew that my anxiety disorder could be crippling, and I had already warned them, only half joking, that I might spend the lunch hiding under the table, and that they would just have to find a way to explain that writers are notoriously eccentric. And they are. But I knew that I was more than that. Mentally ill. It's a phrase that once scared me, but now I wear it like an old jacket. Comfortable, but ugly. It keeps me warm when people look at me as if I have lost my mind. I haven't. I'm mentally ill, and there is a difference. At least there is to me. I'm very aware of the fact that I'm not right. I know hiding under tables and in bathrooms isn't normal. I know that I've carved out a life that lets me hide when I need to, because I wouldn't survive any other way. I know that when my anxiety attacks hit, my body isn't actually going to kill me in spite of how it feels. I know that when I get suicidal thoughts stuck in my head, I have to tell someone else who can help, because depression is a cunning manipulator. I know that depression lies to you. I know that the few weeks a year when my face feels like a stranger's mask and nothing but physical pain can bring me back to my body, that there is a limit to how much I can hurt myself and still be safe in my own bed. I know I am crazy, and that has made all the difference. The luncheon went well. I mingled somewhat unsuccessfully with important people, but I managed to intrigue them enough that they wanted to interview me for important pieces that might help the book that I'd been writing for the last 10 years. The book was a sort of dark comedy, and the cover featured a small taxidermied mouse dressed as Hamlet, holding the skull of another dead mouse in his hands, as if it was a tiny Yorick. I'd asked my publisher to put my dead mouse, Hamlet von Schnitzel, on the cover of the book as a joke, but we could come up with nothing better for such a strange little book, and that's why I was constantly apologizing to the sales team for making them have to sell a book with 1 1/4 dead rodents on the cover. After the first set of drinks was ordered, my editor, Amy, had a small but perfect speech, which would have been nicer than any of the speeches given at my wedding if I had actually had friends when I got married who knew me enough to give speeches. Then she called me up to say a few words, and I shakily welcomed everyone and thanked them for coming on this strange journey with me. And then I panicked a little because I couldn't think of how else to end the speech, and that's when I found myself pulling one and a quarter dead mice out of my purse in the middle of a fancy New York restaurant. The waitstaff looked a little stunned, and I think I might have hidden my face behind the tiny rodent and said something in a squeaky mouse voice about the importance of being true to yourself. Most of the people in the room knew nothing about me, and even less about Hamlet von Schnitzel, but my vaguely panicked agent smiled encouragingly, and so everyone else smiled along with her. The whole luncheon was fuzzy, but it seemed to go well. My favorite part was when everyone else was leaving and one of the waitresses snuck back in to tell me she was a huge fan and couldn't wait to read my book. I suspected my editor had paid her to say that, but I saw her nervous, wild-eyed look barely masked by a skin of propriety, and I realized she was part of my tribe. I hugged her tight and thanked her. She probably never realized how much I needed her right then, a keystone to keep me steady in a sea of normal semi-strangers. I went straight from the luncheon to the small studio where I was recording my audiobook. I'd had to convince them to let me narrate my own book because most audiobooks are read by professional, velvet-toned actors, whereas my voice sounds as if Minnie Mouse were sick and spent too much time in Texas. I was terrified, certain that the pounding of my heart would be heard on the tape. They could literally pick up every rumble of my stomach. How could they fail to hear the terror in my voice? And the answer is, they couldn't. And so they'd stop me every few seconds and ask me to try the line again. Eventually, they told me to take a break and clear my head, and I left so that they could probably call Betty White in to see if she could take over. And that's when I realized how much I wanted to read my own story in my own voice. I hid in the bathroom, and I sent out a frantic text to my friend Neil Gaiman, a brilliant author and narrator, telling him that I was panicked and I was just about to lose the chance to tell my own story because my voice betrayed just how weak and insignificant that I knew I was. He sent back a single line that has never left me. Pretend you're good at it. It seemed too simple, but it was all I had, so I scrawled the words on my arm and I repeated it as a mantra. I walked back into the studio pretending to be someone who was amazing at reading her own story. I finished an entire paragraph without interruption. Then I looked up and the producer stared at me and said, "I don't know what you just did, but keep doing it." And I said, "I just did a lot of cocaine." And she looked a bit aghast, and so I said, "No, I'm just kidding. I just got some really good advice from a friend." The next day of recording was just as nerve-wracking as the day before, but I looked at the words on my arm again, "Pretend you're good at it." And I took a deep breath and I pretended to have the confidence I needed. And then I said, "You know what this audiobook needs? More cowbell." And then I sang the theme from Annie because I'd always want to sing on a New York stage and I figured this was going to be as close as I'd ever come. And then I suggested that they hire James Earl Jones to read the rest of the book or a Darth Vader impersonator if he wasn't available. They laughed. I laughed. And I felt better, and I pretended I was good at it. And somehow, I was. I write this mantra on myself every single time I have to get on stage or do a book reading. Pretend you're good at it. I'd like to think that one day I'll be able to leave off the pretend, but for now, pretending works just fine. It gave me the confidence to finish the audiobook that day and to be able to laugh and enjoy the experience instead of cowering in the bathroom. But later that night in my hotel room, I was hard-pressed to find something to laugh about. It was 2 a.m., and I was in the midst of a medium-sized panic attack, the kind where it seems like there are wild hamsters in your heart and you can feel the dread pressing down on you, but you don't quite feel like you're dying yet. I took some anti-anxiety meds, and I tried to snap myself out of it by pacing, but the bitter cold had made my hands and feet swell from my rheumatoid arthritis, and one foot was so swollen that the back of my heel split, seeping blood into my slipper. I sat with my foot in the bath, watching the water turn red as I waited for the bleeding to stop. I took deep, measured breaths, and I tried to convince myself that being trapped in a tiny hotel, half of a country away from my home, was fine. It was an adventure, one I was taking with a dead mouse and a foot they might have to amputate. And just when the panic attack got strong enough that I thought that I might scream, I looked outside and I saw the most amazing thing. I saw snow. To most people, snow is not a big deal. It's a hassle at best. But to a girl born and raised in Texas, snow is magical. The giant snowflakes came down in enormous clumps, gleaming against the dark brick of the building my window faced, and it was lovely and calming. I tried to open the window to stick my hand out, but it was painted shut, and I cursed silently. I watched the snow fall for an hour as I waited for my foot to stop bleeding, and I wished it was light enough outside for me to go and play in the snow. "It's snowing, you guys," I tweeted to everyone in the world who honestly didn't care. And then at 4 a.m., I decided that the only thing that would cure my insomnia, anxiety, would be a long walk in the snow. I pulled a coat on over my nightgown, slipped on my flats, and went downstairs. My foot was killing me as I tiptoed outside, nodding quietly to the confused man at the night desk, who looked puzzled to see me leave in my pajamas. Then I walked out into a New York night, which was muffled by snow, a thick white blanketing of powder that not a single person had put a step into. I could hear a drunk yelling for a cab down the street, but it was comforting to not be the only person out in that weather. Sure, I was in my pajamas and I had been stabbed in the foot by arthritis, but at least I was mostly sober and not too far from a warm bed. My foot ached. As I took a step, the sharp pain shot all the way up to my spine, and that's when I just said, "Oh, fuck it," and carefully stepped out of my shoes into the gleaming white snow. It was freezing, but the cold effortlessly numbed my feet and aching hands. I walked quietly, barefoot, to the end of the block, leaving my shoes behind to remind me how to find my way home. I stood at the end of the street, catching snow in my mouth, and laughed softly to myself as I realized that without my insomnia and anxiety and pain, I'd never have been awake to see the city that never sleeps asleep and blanketed up for the winter. I smiled and felt silly, but in the best possible way. As I turned and looked back to the hotel, I noticed that my footprints leading out to the city were mismatched. One side was glistening, small, and white. The other was misshapen from my limp, and each heel was pooled with spots of bright red blood. It struck me as a metaphor for my life. One side, light and magical, always seeing the good, lucky. The other side, bloodied, stumbling, never quite able to keep up. It was like the Jesus beach footprint in the sand poem, except with less Jesus and more bleeding. It was my life, there in red and white, and I was grateful for it. Miss? It was the man from the front desk, leaning tentatively out the front door with a concerned look on his face. "Coming," I said. I felt a bit foolish, and I considered trying to clarify, but then I thought better of it. There was no way to explain to the stranger how my mental illness had just gifted me with a magical moment. I realized it would have sounded a bit crazy, but that made sense. After all, I was a bit crazy, and I didn't even have to pretend to be good at it. I was a damn natural. Chapter 7. George Washington's Dildo. The first argument I had with Victor this week. "Hey, Victor, are you busy?" "No, what's up?" Are we fighting?" "Why?" Victor asked. "What did you do?" "I didn't do anything. I was just at my computer, and then I remembered that you were talking to me in my office, and then I realized that you weren't there anymore." "That was like an hour ago." "Yeah, I know, but I couldn't remember you leaving, and I thought maybe you stormed out on me because I wasn't paying attention to you, but then I didn't notice because I wasn't paying attention." "You don't remember me leaving?" Victor asked. "No, it's like, you know when you drive home, but then you can't remember driving home once you get there?" "Hmm," Victor said. "Yep, we're fighting." "Oh. Were we fighting before I brought this all up?" "Nope." "Got it. Well, if it makes it any better, I was coming in here to say that you were right to storm out because clearly I was not paying attention, and so technically, I think you have to accept my apology, especially since it's for a fight that never actually happened." "Nope," Victor said. "But I didn't do anything wrong, and I'm apologizing for a fight that we never even had." "No, you didn't even realize I wasn't in the room until an hour after I left." "Ah," I said, "but you didn't notice that I didn't notice, and I'm the one who brought that to your attention. So if anything, you should be thanking me. I'm like the George Washington of marital fights." "What the? Well, because he told on himself for chopping down that tree, and everyone was all, 'Good job, George.' And then that probably turned him into a tagger because the best praise he ever got was for vandalism." Victor stared at me. What the hell are you talking about? A tagger. It's a graffiti artist. I know what a tagger is, Jenny. It's what kids call a vandal. Kids, are you implying that I'm childish? Oh, of course not. You're the George Washington of marital aids. Ew, I said. You're the one who said it. Oh, no, no. Marital aids are sex toys. You just called me George Washington's dildo. Victor shook his head. I'm pretty positive I have never called anyone that. Well, you implied it. Jesus, Jenny, just stop talking. I can't. The marriage books say you're not supposed to leave a fight unresolved. Fine, we're not fighting. Well, then why am I apologizing? I have no idea, Jenny. Everything after George Washington's dildo was a blur. I sighed. You can say that again. No, actually, I never want to have to say that again. Okay, I said. Deal. Huh? I promise to never make you say anything about George Washington's dildo if you promise to stop getting mad at me about fights that we aren't actually having. Victor looked at me. Do you ever wish that we had normal fights like normal couples? I shook my head. Never. Victor paused. Me either. Winner of the argument? Neither of us. Or possibly both. It's hard to say. Chapter 8. I'm not psychotic. I just need to get in front of you in line. This year, my doctor prescribed me antipsychotics. To keep the psychotics away? I asked, jokingly. She was not joking. She promised me that this did not mean that I was psychotic, but assured me that in small doses, this drug, made for schizophrenics, could decrease the length of my depressive episodes if I used it as sort of a side dish to go with my antidepressants. So, of course, I took the drug. Drugs are magic. You take a pill and you feel happy. You take another one and you feel less hungry. You take another pill and you have minty breath. That last pill was actually a Tic Tac, but you get the picture. There is nothing better than hearing that there is a drug that will fix a terrible problem, unless you also hear that that drug is for treating schizophrenia and possibly that it kills fairies every time you take it. Frankly, I think it's the word that scares me. Antipsychotic. I dare you to find a drug that will freak people out more when they're rifling through your medicine cabinet during parties, unless maybe it's medicine for contagious explosive combustion of the urethra, which I don't count because it doesn't exist, I hope. Surely the people naming antipsychotics could have come up with something less hurtful. After all, we don't call Viagra the floppy dick pill, and hardly any of us refer to anger management therapy as maybe just stop being such an asshole class. I honestly can't think of any drug that has more of a stigma than antipsychotics. Truthfully, though, there are some advantages to being on antipsychotics. First off, you can say you're on antipsychotics. This might seem silly, but when you go to the pharmacy and you're standing in line with 20 germy people sneezing all over the place, you can honestly say, "Would you mind if I went first? I have to pick up my antipsychotic meds, and I really needed them yesterday." This tactic also works for grocery lines, the DMV, and some buffets. The second advantage of being on antipsychotics is they can actually help. In the time I've been on them, I've hurt myself less, I feel more stable. The blue men who live in my closet try to sell me fewer cookies, and most of those squirrels plotting against me have disappeared. That last sentence was a joke, but only people on mild antipsychotics will laugh at it because everyone else is afraid it's true. It's not true. Squirrels are actually real, and they don't disappear no matter how many pills you take. Frankly, I'm shocked at how often I have to explain this. Some people will say that drugs are never the answer, and I respect their opinion. But sometimes drugs are the answer, and I think you need to be flexible. In fact, if you ask the same people, what is it that Nancy Reagan said that you should always say no to? They will all say drugs, and then I'll say correct. Drugs are the right answer, so technically, we're both right. Then I point out that drugs are often very bad for you, and that you have to do your research first and realize that there is a difference between drugs and medication. You can tell the difference because the first ones are ironically much cheaper and easier to get than the latter, and also because the use of medicine requires constant doctor supervision, treatment, and blood work. Being on medication for mental illness is not fun, nor is it easy, and no one I have ever known does it just for kicks. Kids don't buy black market Prozac to take to raves. People don't use B12 shots as a gateway drug to heroin. The side effects and troubles with taking medication are very real, and if you have a chronic mental illness, are something you have to deal with for the rest of your life. Even if a drug is working for a while, it might stop working, and you'll have to start all over again with something new, which can be incredibly frustrating and disheartening. And then you have to deal with the side effects of the new drug, which can include feeling excessively stabby when coupled with some asshole telling you that your medication not working is just proof that you didn't need medication at all. I can't think of another type of illness where the sufferer is made to feel guilty and question their own self-care when their medications need to be changed. When I went on my first antidepressant, it had the side effect of making me fixated on suicide, which is sort of the opposite of what you want. It's a rare side effect, so I switched to something else that did work. Lots of concerned friends and family felt that the first medication's failure was a clear sign that drugs were not the answer. If they were, I would have been fixed. Clearly, I wasn't as sick as I said I was if the medicine didn't work for me. And that sort of makes sense, because when you have cancer, the doctor gives you the best medicine, and if it doesn't shrink the tumor immediately, then that's a pretty clear sign that you were just faking it for attention. I mean, cancer is a serious, often fatal disease we've spent billions of dollars studying and treating, so obviously a patient would never have to try multiple drugs, surgeries, radiation, etc., to find something that works specifically for them. And once the cancer sufferer is in remission, they're set for life, because once they've learned how not to have cancer, they're good. And if they let themselves get cancer again, they can just do whatever they did last time. Once you find the right cancer medication, you're pretty much immune from that disease forever. And if you get it again, it's probably just a reaction to too much gluten or not praying correctly, right? Well, no. But that same completely ridiculous reasoning is what people with mental illness often hear, not just from well-meaning friends or people who were able to fix their own issues without medication, or people who don't understand that mental illness can be dangerous and even fatal if untreated, but also from someone much closer and more manipulative. We hear it from ourselves. We listen to that small voice in the back of our heads that says, this medication is taking money away from your family. This medication messes with your sex drive or your weight. This medication is for people with real problems, not just people who feel sad. No one ever died from being sad, except that they do. And when we see celebrities who fall victim to depression's lies, we think to ourselves, how in the world could they have killed themselves? They had everything. But they didn't. They didn't have a cure for an illness that convinced them that they were better off dead. Whenever I start to doubt if I'm worth the eternal trouble of medication and therapy, I remember those people who let the fog win. And I push myself to stay healthy. I remind myself that I'm not fighting against me. I'm fighting against a chemical imbalance, a tangible thing. I remind myself of the cunning untrustworthiness of the brain, both in the mentally ill and in the mentally stable. I remind myself that professional mountain climbers are often found naked and frozen to death with their clothes folded neatly nearby because severe hypothermia can make a person feel confused and hot and convince you to do incredibly irrational things we would never expect. Brains are like toddlers. They are wonderful and should be treasured, but that doesn't mean that you should trust them to take care of you in an avalanche or to process serotonin effectively. I have never had a full psychotic breakdown. I am seldom delusional. I've never hallucinated anything that didn't come from too much of a drug that I probably shouldn't have taken anyway. I'm just broken, but in a way that makes me me. My drugs don't define me. I'm not psychotic. I'm not dangerous. The drugs I take are just a pinch of salt, a little seasoning in life, if you will. Your baked potatoes would be fine without it, but everyone will tell you that a pinch of salt can make all the difference. I am your potatoes, and I am better with salt. This is a bad analogy. Okay, how about this? My taking low-level antipsychotics is like using just enough rum to make a good slice of rum cake, but not using enough to get alcohol poisoning and choke to death on your own vomit. The first is medicinal, and the second one is gross and unsanitary. And I know some of you are saying that cake isn't medicinal. Really? Cake isn't medicinal? Who's crazy now, asshole? The whole world could be cured with enough cake and antipsychotics, which actually makes sense because you can't make a cake without salt, can you? Wait, can you make a cake without salt? I actually have no idea. I don't know much about baking. I know there's something white in there. Maybe it's flour I'm thinking about. I just wrote salt because it brought all my metaphors back together. Sort of. Probably not. It's hard to tell. I blame this whole chapter on the antipsychotics. And a footnote here. This is the third advantage to taking antipsychotics. You can blame all sorts of bullshit on them. It's like blaming it on your period, except it's a period that never ends. And no one ever questions you because you have a mental handicap. A scary, intimidating, possibly dangerous medical handicap. Plus, now you can use the handicap bathrooms with no guilt. Everyone wins. Who wants cake? Chapter 9. Why would I want to do more when I'm already doing so well at nothing? Victor and I have different ideas about what we should do in our spare time. In my spare time, I like to stare at shit. I mean, not literally. I like to stare at the TV or the internet or a book or cat videos. There's a lot of sitting very still and not moving involved. I suspect in a former life I was probably a statue because I am profoundly good at it. Victor, on the other hand, spends his spare time creating new businesses, writing reference books, gleefully finding errors on financial forms, and telling me how I should spend my spare time. In Victor's type A world, there should be no spare time. His motto is, time to lean, time to clean. Except replace lean with sleep and replace clean with build a multinational business and pull everything out of the closet with the intention of organizing it but not actually follow through and just leave it for your wife to sort out. My motto has always been, time enjoyed is never wasted. Except replace enjoyed with drunk and never wasted with never not a good idea. I think it has something to do with the fields we work in. For most of our marriage, Victor has been a workaholic entrepreneur or an executive of a successful company. He really enjoys it, which makes him dangerously questionable or at least mildly sociopathic. He easily fills empty time with specific tasks that have a defined start and end. His emails are always answered with quick, smart, and often vaguely condescending directives that make people never want to email him again, so he's always caught up on his correspondence. My unopened emails often number into the thousands, and once every few months, I'll panic at how far behind I am, and I will send a form letter to everyone that reads, "Hello, I totally suck. I'm just now opening this. Did you still need me? I am so sorry. I am not to be trusted. Hugs, me." Then I declare email bankruptcy, delete everything, and start a whole new email account and never, ever go back to the last one. My old email addresses are like bars I've been kicked out of and can never return to. It's a ridiculous and assholish system, but I found that it works for me, and I have never received a single complaint. Victor says that's because it's impossible to receive a complaint on an account I never check again. I suspect it's because everyone is equally behind and they appreciate my honesty. My job is to write ridiculous things on my blog, in books, on used napkins that get misplaced almost immediately. It's part of my job to be aware of the latest hedgehog in a bathtub video. It's research. There's also a lot of behind-the-scenes work that non-right-brain people don't see happening. For example, when I have writer's block, I sometimes have to refill my creative cup. This is an actual phrase my shrink has used, and I made her write it down so I could show Victor that I had a doctor's note explaining my behavior, but I lost the note in my stack of used napkins and related flotsam, so he just had to take my word for it, which he did not because he is sadly untrusting. Refilling your creative cup means different things to different people. But to me, it looks a lot like watching Doctor Who marathons or reading David Sedaris books while screaming, "Why do you make it look so easy?" Sometimes it looks like driving to pet stores so that I can pull out all the ferrets from their bins and drape them over me to make them into tickly, freaked out coats. Occasionally, it looks like me drawing doodles of penises on the overdue tax forms that Victor has passive-aggressively taped to my computer monitor. In summation, I spend an impressive amount of time doing absolutely nothing. Like, I'm at pro level, because that's how artistic genius works. And because I'm very, very lazy. Now, some people will say that if you have writer's block, you should just start writing anyway, because then you'll at least accomplish something. However, I have never liked anything that I've been forced to write, so I'm pretty sure all that accomplishes is a bunch of shitty writing, and I already have enough of that even when real inspiration hits. Good writing cannot be forced. This is why you don't have any classic beloved books filled with the begrudging and angry mandatory essays of students who didn't want to write them, and why you almost never see college dissertations go viral on Reddit. In other words, if you spent most of the morning reading Twitter and then scribbling weird, indecipherable notes to yourself on your arm, then you are probably on the right track to becoming a successful artist. Or to becoming homeless. Those things aren't mutually exclusive. You would think, after 18 years of marriage, Victor and I would be more accepting of each other's working styles, but no. Victor spent most of this morning directing several conference calls, yelling at plumbers, rolling over our 401ks into something that sounded even more boring than 401ks. I'd stopped listening at that point. I, on the other hand, spent most of the morning coming up with good names for cats that I don't currently have. My current favorite is The President. It is an awesome name because you would constantly find yourself saying things like, "The President will not stop sitting on my keyboard," or "The President just threw up on the new rug," or "I like sleeping with the President, but why do I always wake up with his butt on my face?" I tried to tell Victor about how awesome The President would be to have in bed on a cold night, and he was like, "No more cats. You have too many cats already." But then I just stared at him and said, "Too bad, overruled. You can't turn down a request from the President." He disagreed, but I'm pretty sure that's considered treason. I called the pet store where I snuggle the ferrets to ask if they had any leads on any patriotic-looking cats who needed a new home, but they recognized my voice and informed me that the manager had just enacted a policy of, quote, only one loose ferret at a time, and that's ridiculous because the most that you can possibly make with a single ferret is a small pillbox hat, which uses claws instead of bobby pins. And I was a little upset, and I may have said something like, "This is outrageous. The President will not stand for these kinds of cuts." And then they asked what I was talking about, and I considered explaining that ferret cuts were much worse than government budget cuts because everyone suffers when you cut ferrets, especially the ferrets. But then I remembered that I hadn't adopted the President yet. And I sort of thought it might be inappropriate to throw around the weight of my non-existent cat all willy-nilly. Victor agreed that it was extremely inappropriate, although not for the same reasons. I told Victor that not having a cat named the President had already crippled me once today, and that the President would probably get into all kinds of crazy shenanigans that I could write about. I argued that my buying the President was basically the equivalent of his buying office supplies, so it was fiscally irresponsible to not adopt a cat called the President. At this point, Victor may have screamed, "You cannot have any more cats. I'm the one who has to clean up after them, and I'll be damned if I'm going to scoop the President's shit, too." He paused and shook his head at his own questionable phrasing, but I smiled contentedly because he had just proven my point, as that was exactly the kind of argument that would be gold on my blog. In fact, the President has already given me 4 paragraphs in this book, and he doesn't even exist yet. It's possible he might be the most productive president we've ever had. Victor walked away before we could finish discussing the issue, so I wrote myself a reminder on the tax form that he taped to the monitor, "Get a litter box for the President." I suspected the IRS would be confused, and possibly not in a good way, so I added, "I'm not referring to your boss. I totally voted for that guy. Please don't audit me. I'm kind to animals and small children. If anything, you should audit my husband, who thinks the President should just live in a cage rather than get adopted by my daughter, who would totally dress him up in old Cabbage Patch Kid clothes and snuggle him like crazy cakes." Then Victor came back, saw the now vandalized tax papers, and just stared at me in disappointment. I explained that it would probably be better if he just did all my tax papers in the future. He claimed that would be illegal, and I told him if the President were here, he'd be just fine with it, and that's basically the same thing as getting presidential approval on everything. Cats don't give a shit about stuff, so basically the President would automatically approve of everything we did by default. Except for maybe Victor's use of the super soaker to keep the cats off the kitchen counters. The President would probably not approve of that. Case in point, just this moment, Victor walked in and asked what I was doing, and I told him I was writing about how much he hates the President, and he started yelling at me about using my time more wisely. Frankly, it's not even that we disagree about my use of time. It's more about how completely far we are from agreeing about what would be a credible use of my time. Actual things Victor has suggested that I do in my spare time. Idea number 1, open an art gallery. Idea two, open a comic book store. Idea three, open a restaurant. Idea four, anything that doesn't involve ferrets. Actual things I'd consider doing in my spare time. Idea one, start a club for small monkeys. Set them up with people who like to have their hair played with. Note, there could be some technical problems because typically monkeys only pick bugs out of hair, and some people might be weird about getting insects dumped into their hair. But people who'd pay to have monkeys play with their hair are not entirely predictable, so it could still work. Or maybe we could just dump edible glitter into people's hair. And that's where we'd make our money, selling edible monkey glitter. I don't know how monkeys are with edible glitter, but it's got to be a step up from their current diet. I mean, you eat bugs, monkeys. Stop being so goddamn pretentious. Also, I have a real-life model to base this on because my dad's friend has a pet monkey, Amber, who likes to pick scabs on people's scalps. So we call her Amber the Scab Monkey, which is a terrible name. Who names a monkey Amber? Total waste of a monkey. Also, I'm not sure how many people have scabs on their heads, but I suspect if they're letting monkeys dig around in their hair, you're going to end up with scabs. This business builds itself. Idea number two. Adopt a stray cat and name it the president. Set it up with a Twitter account. Sell pardons from my cat you can buy for whenever you forget your wife's birthday or when you accidentally let too many ferrets loose in a store. Like, I know you're still mad at me, but I do have a pardon from the president, and that's got to count for something. Idea three, watch videos of goats doing funny things. In the end, Victor and I both want the same thing, for me to get my shit together. And this is where we find our common ground. And when Victor starts up again about opening an art gallery that sells comics and crepes, I respond with the same variation of what I always say. It is a very good idea, Victor, but right now I'm just too involved with writing, catching up with TV, developing edible monkey glitter, and the president. But maybe in my next life, I will do that. And it could be true. Maybe in my next life, I will open a successful business and buy and sell stocks and memorize my driver's license number and do my taxes on time. Or maybe in my next life, I'll open a deli that specializes in mashed potato sandwiches, which are mashed potatoes and tater tots stuffed inside warm potato bread and spaghetti pies, no definition needed. And I'll have a big sign that says, "The president eats here." And he does because cats fucking love spaghetti. And at least Victor won't be mad at me in my next life. Unless that is, he comes back in his next life as one of my customers, and then he'll shake his head a little confusedly as he steers his third wife away from the cat on the counter eating a spaghetti pie. But I bet Victor will turn back once more to see a very happy woman handing a potato sandwich to her glittery monkey waiter, and I imagine he'll feel a small pang of regret and sadness. Probably because he'll never know that potato sandwiches are fucking delicious. P.S. Victor just read this chapter and he agreed that yes, potato sandwiches are delicious, but stated that he would more likely be looking back to see a woman covered in stolen ferrets getting arrested for not handing in her taxes on time because none of her glitter-eating monkeys loved her enough to make her do the required paperwork. I really fucking hate it when he's right.